Hello there and welcome. Today is Friday, March 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president's former campaign chair is given a much lighter prison sentence than prosecutors recommended.
I think the fear among some judges is that they would actually be coming down against the president in a case like this, or coming down against the Republican Party. I'm hoping that's not the case, but politics does play a role.
An American journalist is arrested and released in Venezuela. A new report outlines the world's most polluted city. Also ahead, what some groups are doing for International Women's Day. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, was sentenced on Thursday by a U.S. judge to less than 4 years in prison, far shy of federal sentencing guidelines for financial crimes uncovered during special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia's role in the 2016 election. U.S. District Judge T.S. Ellis imposed the 47-month sentence on Manafort during a hearing in Alexandria, Virginia, in which the veteran Republican political consultant asked for mercy but did not express remorse for his actions. Ellis also ordered Manafort, who was brought into the courtroom in a wheelchair, to pay a fine of $50,000 and restitution of just over $24 million. Manafort was found guilty by a jury last August on tax fraud, bank fraud, and failing to disclose foreign bank accounts. After the sentencing, Manafort's attorney, Kevin Downing, made a brief statement.
Mr. Manafort finally got to speak for himself. He made clear he accepts responsibility for his conduct. And I think most importantly, what you saw today is the same thing that we had said from day one. There is absolutely no evidence that Paul Manafort was involved with any collusion with any government official from Russia.
Manafort faces sentencing in a separate case next Wednesday in Washington on two conspiracy charges, to which he pleaded guilty last September. While he faces a statutory maximum of 10 years in the Washington case, where that judge could potentially stack that on top of the sentence imposed on the Virginia case rather than allowing them to run concurrently. Joining us to talk about it, criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, what is your initial reaction?
Pretty extraordinary when you look at the behavior of Mr. Manafort and what he was charged with, what he was convicted of. This could have been a much, much longer sentence. The fact that he only was sentenced to 47 months with good time, with time served, he's going to have less than 3 years to serve. There's another case that's out there right now, but with less than 3 years to serve on what he was convicted of, that's pretty extraordinary.
The judge seems somewhat hostile toward the prosecution, Mueller's prosecutors, kind of throughout the whole case. Why do you think this judge has been seeming much more sympathetic to Manafort, who was convicted by a jury, than he was toward the government's case?
No, it's always difficult. There's this perception, I think, right now that this case is under a microscope. There are a lot of people watching it, and I think the fear amongst some judges is that they would actually be coming down against the president in a case like this, or coming down against the Republican Party. I'm hoping that's not the case, but politics does play a role. They have lifetime appointments necessarily, but that still doesn't change the influence that that kind of pressure can have on a judge's decision. And one of the things that judges have the ability to decide on is a sentence.
The judge also made mention of the fact that, again, seeming very sympathetic to Manafort, that he had otherwise lived a decent life. What we're hearing has been something completely different about his, you know, work with these foreign governments and a lot of illegal lobbying, et cetera. It seems a little bit confusing to what we've been hearing up to this point.
It does seem myopic, doesn't it? When you look at what this judge actually said about Manafort's life, and yet you turn around and look at all of his behavior, all of his connections, and what that actually may have actually meant in the world, it really is kind of extraordinary to hold him up and say, wow, you've done really great things in your life. Because I think there's a whole lot of people who are out there in the world who are saying, really? Give me a chance. I want to tell you what he's done.
Does this send a message that people can commit these sorts of crimes and garner sympathy? And does this also validate the president in some way?
Well, I think the biggest concern is this, and I'm consistent with what the prosecutors are saying in this case. If you look at the sophistication of what Manafort did and how he did it over and over, with particularity and with expertise, the idea that you would simply slap him on the wrist for something like this is really not encouragement necessarily to others down the road, but it really does highlight the point that, you know what, if they get you, they're not going to get you that bad.
We know that Manafort has another sentencing hearing next week in another courtroom facing other charges. Do you expect that judge will take a cue from this one, or will that be completely different?
It's always hard to tell. Every judge is different, and they are somewhat independent. And yet, that being said, they're also human. They're going to be looking at what other judges have done and look at responsibility and obligation. And they also want to be somewhat consistent. And so as a result, my fear, for lack of a better word, is that you may see something comparable.
Manafort's attorneys came out and made a very brief statement after the sentencing, basically saying this just proves that Mr. Manafort was not involved in any collusion with the government of Russia. But this sentencing in this case was not about collusion.
No, this case wasn't about that at all. He is a criminal. There's no question about it. But one of the big issues is he was a criminal because he didn't pay his taxes, because he didn't follow through with the laws of the United States, and he was hiding money, in this case, in excess of $16 million. That is a federal crime. The collusion issue was something that may be addressed down the road, but this one you can't deny.
All right, well, that was criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Brussels court convicts a Frenchman of murder in a Jewish museum attack. China's Huawei sues the U.S. government over a ban. Michael Cohen sues the Trump Organization for unpaid legal fees, and the UN fears armyworm. An armyworm outbreak will worsen Zimbabwe's food insecurity. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A U.S. journalist was seized by security forces at his apartment early Wednesday amid Venezuela's escalating political turmoil, according to lawyers and press freedom groups. A squad of five men dressed in black uniforms and carrying a written order demanded entry into the Caracas apartment building of journalist Cody Weddle. They emerged 2 hours later with the Virginia-born Weddle carrying a large suitcase and equipment bag. Weddle says Venezuelan security forces asked him questions on tape while he was in detention.
Now I'm going to be the journalist, and it was very clear that they wanted me to say several things, political things. They wanted me to say that Nicolas Maduro is still the president.
Since the start of the year, Venezuela has been shaken by political unrest, sometimes erupting in violence, after U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido announced he was invoking the Constitution as head of Congress to wrest power from President Maduro. Weddle says he knew his family would be concerned when they heard about his detention in Venezuela.
I was thinking about my mother, yes, and that's the only time I teared up a little bit when thinking about what was going through her head, because I knew she was so worried.
Weddle's apparent arrest came the same day as Maduro ordered the expulsion of Germany's ambassador after the envoy expressed support for Guaido, escalating a diplomatic standoff with a group of about 50 nations that recognize the opposition leader as Venezuela's interim president. South Korea's air quality is the worst of a group of 35 wealthy nations recently tested by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Some of South Korea has been smothered in record levels of fine particles of dust, prompting the government to issue 6 straight days of emergency alerts and causing people to wear masks while outside to protect their health from the air pollution. VOA's Kim Lewis talked to correspondent Steve Miller in Seoul about the risks the poor air quality poses for sensitive groups such as children, the elderly, and anyone with respiratory illness.
Well, you have to first remember that South Korea is a country of about 50 million people, half of which live in the Seoul metropolitan area. So it's very densely populated. So as people tend to use their own cars, you get pollutants in the air. And that's only part of the story. So for years and years and years, there's been this phenomenon called the yellow dust here in South Korea. And what that is typically during the winter months, strong winds cascade over the Gobi Desert in China, pick up the sand and blow it through the air. It cascades over China, down through the Korean Peninsula, and sometimes even into Japan. And for years and years and years, that was the end of it. But as more people drive, as we get more coal factories, there have been more and more pollutants into the air. And as climate change continues on the Earth, the season has actually grown in length as well. So while it was only used to be a few months we'd have this bad air season in South Korea. Now it's extended to sometimes more than half a year. So right now we just finished six straight days of alerts from the government where the air quality was deemed unhealthy. And the PM2.5, that's the very small particles that can cause cancer. They were very prevalent, so much so you could actually see the difference in the sky when these waves came through.
How do people cope with this type of poor air quality on a daily basis?
A lot of people wear masks to kind of filter out some of the air, but to really try and get some of the benefit to really protect yourself, you have to use really strong masks that are sealed around your face. The government sends out alerts when the air quality is really, really bad. In fact, there was one day I was walking down the street just after work to let us know that the following day there's going to be a bad air quality day. And the emergency alert system on everyone's mobile phone went off all at once. And everyone stopped, reached into their purse, reached into their pocket, reached into their bag, almost simultaneously to look at the alert. That's how people mainly cope. They try to stay indoors. I was coming back from a reporting trip, and I was inside a taxi cab. And even though the windows were sealed, even though the car was on recirculation of the air, the taxi cab driver also had a mask on inside the cab.
What type of action is the government taking to actually reduce this poor air quality?
So what the Moon administration is doing, they're actually making one of their key programs this year. And so what they're trying to do is they're reaching out to China to try and develop what's called an early warning system. So if there are big gusts of wind coming along, that there's a way to alert people sooner than that. The government's also instituting a program to try and seed clouds to make some artificial rain. They did that a while back, and the first tests weren't exactly successful, but they hope to have it in place sometime in the next year or so. And the last thing they're doing is on bad air days, what they're trying to do is get people to stay off the roads if they have older, higher polluting vehicles. And those are the three main things they're trying to do to help address the problem.
That's VOA Seoul correspondent Steve Miller. And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. For months, school students in various countries have been protesting against the climate policies of their respective governments. In Australia, Belgium, France, Germany, Britain, and more, they attend weekly rallies to call out politicians who, in the students' minds, are doing too little to combat climate change. Here in the U.S., students across the country have launched a campaign urging cities and counties to support the national proposal Green New Deal. They have been meeting with local political leaders to urge national action, and they are being supported and mentored by a nonprofit group called iMatter, which supports young leaders to inspire political will in their communities for necessary and just climate change. I had a chance to speak with 18-year-old Cindy Chung, who attends a high school in New Jersey, and asked her about iMatter. Is it some sort of mentorship program to teach young people actually how to be effective activists?
That's exactly what it is. There's so many resources on, like, the website. We have, like, resources to connect with other iMatter members across the country on how to, like, speak and how to present and draft. So, yeah, I guess it's sort of like training to become environmental activists.
Tell us a little bit about this nationwide campaign you're participating in now and what the plan of action is.
My resolution was originally geared towards trying to get my local city to reach carbon neutrality by 2030. And I know for a lot of more suburban, rural areas like where I'm from, people who may not be so willing to immediately implement such a drastic resolution like that. Ever since our resolution sort of shifted to being more centered on the Green New Deal, a lot of the iMatter groups across the country, that was the two-week span that we chose to actually present to the city council. And in that time span was when the Green New Deal got introduced into Congress and things like that. So all of it was happening at one time. And during that time span, all these youth groups across the country presented to their city councils. So there was lots of media attention about using Sunrise Movement and iMatter being so actively involved in trying to endorse the Green New Deal. So when we did it collectively, there was a lot more, I guess, power to it.
Is that going to continue? Are you going to have more activities like that across the country?
Yes, we're actually talking about that with my mentors. Now, for example, my group presented 2 weeks ago to our city council. So now that we presented, what do we do after the presentation? What's the post-presentation, you know, action agenda? My group, when we presented, we didn't really get a response, yes or no, from the city council. So right now we're working towards trying to find ways to follow up and sort of pressure them into federally endorse the Green New Deal, because you get a group of youth activists to present to the city council, something that a lot of cities have never seen before. It's definitely going to get a lot of, you know, media attention.
Do you think young people are more engaged now than in recent years? And if so, why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think issues like climate change are so time sensitive that, for example, the IPCC report recently issued by the United Nations, they gave us that 11-year limit. If we continue past the 1.5 degrees Celsius increase in temperatures that were projected on, they predict a quote-unquote climate catastrophe. And by the time 2030 hits, I won't even be 30 years old yet, for example. So this is a very time-sensitive issue, and I feel like a lot of the youth are becoming aware of that. We're not the generation that caused a lot of the climate issues, but we're the last generation to be able to do something about it. So we really have no choice but to, you know, use our voices and practice that. Sadly, it is a political issue, even though it shouldn't be. There's so much conflict that comes with that. We're the last generation to be able to do something about it, and it's going to impact the youth more directly and profoundly than it will any other generation. So I think that's why a lot of the youth are becoming so more politically aware and active in a lot of activist causes lately.
I would imagine that it's worrisome to be in the situation like that, where you realize that you are going to be the last generation to be able to make a change from what could be pretty dire for the planet and your future.
Absolutely. Hear all these scary statistics about how the rising sea levels and the temperature rises are only projected to worsen. And like I said, I won't even be 30 by the time the IPCC report predicted that 11-year limit. And it's not a matter of, you know, how are we going to do it? Because we literally have no other alternative other than, you know, the literal end. So it is really scary. And I feel like a lot of people who choose not to act on it or choose to deny climate change's existence flat out entirely, I feel like a lot of that denial comes from fear or not wanting to accept that that could be a possible reality one day. It took me a while to kind of let the idea of the effects of climate change actually like impacting my life. For example, a couple years ago, Hurricane Sandy hit and we live on a coastal area. The effects of it were so devastating, and I never realized until recently that all the flooding and the natural disasters are direct effects of climate change. So I feel like climate change becomes important to you once it becomes personal to you. And when people realize how it can affect them directly, that's when they start acting upon it.
What do you say to lawmakers that support doing something about climate change but feel that the Green New Deal goes too far and won't pass, or so they feel it's just not worth pursuing, rather they would go for a smaller goal?
A lot of people say like the Green New Deal, they call her like radical for proposing something so quote unquote, you know, outrageous. But if you read the clauses of the Green New Deal and the asks of it, these are all stimulus programs and green initiatives that are absolutely necessary for this 1.5 degree Celsius increase to be prevented. There literally is no alternative. And part of why I think youth involvement in such issues are so important is because a lot of lawmakers, and for example, when we presented to the city council, they may, you know, belittle us because we're young or younger than other, like, you know, older activist groups or people who might present to the council. Because we're so young, they might not take us as seriously, which was a big obstacle that we had to face. But we are future voters, and we have to show them that if they won't put aggressive climate policy on their political agendas, we can easily vote someone who will.
All right. We appreciate your coming on and talking to us about what you're doing. That's 18-year-old environmentalist Cindy Chung, who attends a high school in New Jersey. It's International Women's Day, and this year's theme is all about balanced world and a better world, celebrating women's achievements while raising awareness against bias and inequality. Gwen Young is director of the Women's Center's Global Women's Leadership Initiative and Women in Public Service Project, which was founded by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2011. I spoke to Gwen earlier about what the initiative's objectives are.
The Women in Public Service Project has an incredibly simple mission that we want women to hold 50% of leadership positions at decision-making tables across the globe. So the premise is we want women who are about 50% of the population to sit at every sort of level of government leadership. And the why that's important is partly it's just based on we are 50% of the population and using the full talents of your population. There have been some studies as recently as this year that when women lead in government, GDP grows by about 6%, or there's better health of communities when women are leading. There are studies in the corporate sectors that show that diverse boards that include women and others will produce higher profits, better returns, more creative solutions to problems. So there is a sort of business and evidence case. There's the case that why not use half of your population? In government, there's a case of you would like your government to be representative of the people that you serve. And women access government services and live in these communities, so should have a say in what they do, which comes out of maybe a human right or it's the right thing to do.
How much of a disparity is there right now within the population of women versus how many are actually in those roles?
So overall, let's say in parliaments, congresses across the globe, women are about 22% of those parliaments. So there's a huge disparity globally in parliament. The place where women in government are doing the best is civil service, where women are about 43% of civil service employees, and they're 29% of leadership. So the reason they're doing better there is there's more women in the civil service globally, and there's also more women in leadership positions in the civil service globally. So what you'll notice is where we are the best in government at 43%, we're still not at 50%. We're still not at what the population represents, how many women are. Women are coming out in undergraduate and master's programs in the 50 to 60% of those classes are women. But it varies, right? There are like 13 ministers of defense and ministers of foreign affairs who are women across the globe. So very low percentage. So the best is civil service at 43. The figure most people use in terms of politics is women in congresses and lower houses of parliament, 22%. So we're not even a quarter.
Is there a country that is doing the best at having women in those roles? Where does the U.S. stand?
So the U.S. stands in terms of sort of our index, which measures women in the five sectors of government, local and nationally, stands in a place that we call flat parity, where women don't rise very high and where women aren't across all five sectors of government. So we technically don't rank the countries per se, but the country that sort of scores the best, if you will, the top three are Sweden, Canada, and Finland. What that means when you're at that achieving parity is that women are reaching the 50%. They're also reaching the 50%, though they're also going across sectors. So they're not just rising as women's ministers or health ministers or education, but they're rising in finance, in infrastructure, in defense, in foreign affairs. So they're rising also sort of, we call these the glass walls. They're rising across sectors of government to make sure that there really is balance around all critical decisions.
And in the United States, of course, we've never had a woman as president of this country, but we certainly do now for the upcoming 2020 elections have a lot of women running for that office. We know, of course, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton came very close to that. Are you encouraged by the number of women now running?
I am encouraged by the number of women now running, with a little bit of a hesitation. So I'm encouraged because we're at our highest in Congress now than we've been. And so we're at close to 25%, which still isn't 50, but we're getting there. I'm encouraged by the interest. I'm encouraged by the number of women, you know, at the local level. On the flip side, though, we've never had a president. We've never had a woman head the DOD either, right? And so in the United States, what I was saying before is it's still not just the presidency or Congress, but we're still not getting women, you know, heading all industries. Now, we have had women across some at occasion. You know, I'm encouraged, too, because the rise in the women candidates and the type of candidates for 2020 is very interesting. I think what we forget, too, is that the women that came into Congress in the midterm elections, the entire class that came in is much younger. So we're opening the doors for more diverse populations. People are coming out of different types of careers, which I think is really interesting. And to be honest, I'm encouraged because what the midterm election showed us is that when women run, they win. So of the six of the seats that were flipped that went from one party to another, Democratic women flipped over 60% of those seats. So women are winning, and that I'm encouraged by. Part of it is getting them to run. And what we're showing is once they get there, they can win. And so that's a good thing, whereas I think that wasn't something 20 to 30 years ago that was proven yet. But we're still struggling in getting them there. And frankly, in the U.S., we're struggling in getting them in both parties.
All right. That is Gwen Young, director of the Wilson Center's Global Women's Leadership Initiative and Women in Public Service Project. Musician Annie Lennox has a sweet dream that the world will embrace the term global feminism and continue to push for the advancement of women's rights around the globe. The iconic singer and activist teamed with Apple Music to launch a video Thursday in support of global feminism to coincide with International Women's Day today. The nearly two-minute clip features Lennox, Oscar-nominated actor Richard E. Grant, and Grammy-winning singers Ed Sheeran, Mary J. Blige, and Dua Lipa telling the story of women's rights in the last 100 years.
Over the last 100 years, women's rights in some parts of the world have come a long way. More women and girls across the globe now have basic human rights, such as access to education, freedom from violence, eternal health rights, equal employment, and a right to vote. More, but not all. One in three women and girls are impacted by physical or sexual violence in their lifetime. Over 2.7 billion women are legally restricted from having the same choice of jobs as men. Women make up only 22.8% of the world's parliamentarian seats. 99% of all maternal deaths occur in developing countries. Out of the 757 million adults who cannot read or write, 2 out of 3 are women. 603 million women live in countries where domestic violence is not considered a crime. Around the world, we still have a very long way to go before every woman and girl has access to equal rights. That is why we stand together as global feminists.
Well, the Scottish singer achieved major international success in the 1980s with her band The Eurythmics, including 8 Brit Awards and being named Best British Female Artist, record 6 times. Lennox is also a political and social activist who has worked to raise money and awareness for HIV/AIDS as it affects women and children in Africa. Been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's edition. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McKinney.